Welcome to Street Talk, S&P Global Market Intelligence podcast that offers listeners a deep dive into issues facing financial institutions and the investment community.
I'm Nathan Stovall, and today we're talking about the transition away from LIBOR, or the London Interbank Offered Rate. The reason why we're talking about that is that that transition is set to occur in just a few years in 2021. For those who don't know, and most of our listeners likely do, LIBOR is a benchmark rate to tie to trillions of dollars worth of financial contracts across the world, and UK regulators have now said that we need to make the switch. So we're going to talk about what this means for financials and how to prepare, and thankfully I have a great guest here, Jason Granite, who is responsible for the LIBOR transition efforts at Goldman Sachs. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Jason, I thought I wanted to take a step back for those who don't know a little bit of the history of why we're doing this transition before we get into what the transition could mean, and ask you, why are we transitioning away from LIBOR?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say the fundamental reason why we're here is coming out of the crisis from what is over a decade now. It's been that long. The way in which interbank lending changed and the way that monetary policy and banking regulations changed over that 10 years has left it such that the ways in which banks fund themselves is very, very different now. And so, once upon a time, LIBOR, which was originally set up as a lending reference rate and trying to capture bank-to-bank credit risk, kind of the world has evolved in such a way that banks don't really do a lot of bank-to-bank funding and bank-to-bank credit anymore, given the size of central bank balance sheets and size of the way in which monetary policy is managed, and also the different constraints on the leverage ratios, et cetera, that have been put through banks. And then you sprinkle on top of that the fact that the regulators were looking for different vulnerabilities in the system, and they wanted to base these benchmarks off real data, real transactions. And LIBOR has historically been survey and not real transactions. And so when you kind of mix those things together, you get a recipe where the surveys are based off of very, very few transactions, and we have a vulnerability in the system. And we're in the business of trying to fix those vulnerabilities and make the system safer and sounder.
So those are sort of the marching orders or the driving factors. And now we're presented with today, okay, what do we do now that we're going to move away? What, as a firm, is Goldman doing to prepare for the transition?
So before we talk about the firm, I think we have to talk about what the industry is doing.
Sure.
And so, after the industry, after kind of this vulnerability was found in the system, the industry, in the form of public-private partnership, the Fed pulled together a working group, the Bank of England pulled together a working group, and et cetera around the world, to try to think through, A, what rates or what benchmark rates can be used that would kind of comply and be robust enough under this new criteria. And IOSCO published this new criteria, these benchmark principles. They put these public partnership groups together. The one in the U.S. is the Alternative Rates Reference Committee, the ARC, and that group was tasked with figuring out what the replacement rates could be that would be robust and figuring out what the best transition plan for kind of the system. And so SOFR, the Secured Overnight Financing Rate, was selected as an IOSCO-compliant, robust successor rate in the U.S., Reform SONIA was chosen in the UK. ESTR or Euro STR was chosen in Europe, et cetera, et cetera. And so after kind of the industry coalesced around what the replacements are, that's when kind of the firms started their own initiation. And so, it's quite comprehensive what Goldman Sachs and other organizations are doing. We're doing inventorying, make sure we understand where LIBOR is across all the different places, understanding what our legal contract language is across references to LIBOR, understanding what our trading businesses do or don't do with respect to LIBOR, understand our systems and infrastructure kind of relationship with LIBOR. Something as simple as, if we want to book a floating rate note that's linked to SOFR, we need to have SOFR in the drop-down list on a trading system. And so, you know, there's just a very, very comprehensive, across all aspects of the organization, list of things that are kind of being worked on with respect to kind of inventorying and then you know, working through what the changes need to be.
And it sounds like some of it is, you know, basic, make sure it's there. Make sure that there isn't a gap somewhere in any system or any contract where you only have LIBOR as an option, where you have, you know, where we're going, make sure that that is in there.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's some very simple things, as you point out, like make sure we get a data feed of the new rates so that if we reference it, we have the data feed coming in. And some are super complicated where we might have a very complicated option model that's using a LIBOR curve as the reference to price some other complicated derivative structure off of, and we need to rewrite the model. So yeah, you're absolutely right. It goes from simple to complex for sure.
So what Goldman has done sounds pretty comprehensive, and I imagine when you look at the major dealers, they're spending a lot of time on this as well. How do you feel about, and this might be hard for you to answer, but how prepared do you think financial institutions are broadly? I mean, we've seen some things where regulators have come out and sort of pounded the table and said, work on this. And I'm not suggesting it was, you know, directed at Goldman or some of the other bigs, but how prepared do you think the industry is?
Well, you know, first let's take a step back. So if we go back to kind of this time last year, last September, October, the UK regulators, the PRA and the FCA, sent a Dear CEO letter out to major financial and insurance companies. And so any financial or insurance company with any, you know, semblance of a major presence in the UK market that would be regulated in the UK received this Dear CEO letter. And that required a comprehensive inventorying of risks, a comprehensive plan, and also a board level kind of approval and engagement before a submission back to the UK regulators at the end of last year. And so therefore any financial organization, as I indicated, or insurance company that has any touch to the UK system, I would argue that they've last fall's exercise of going through the Dear CEO process clearly put them in position to understand and be quote unquote getting ready. Obviously, that initiation in the UK had ripple effects elsewhere in the world. We've seen similar type Dear CEO or data asks messages coming from the regulator, whether it be from regulators in Asia, others, locals in Europe, et cetera. And so I'd say by now, kind of a year after that, most global regulators have asked for the banks or financial institutions or insurance companies in the case of the U.S., the U.K., pardon my miss there, to have a comprehensive kind of readiness package. I think now the next level of kind of readiness is kind of rolling out. There's started to be some asks of asset management companies. There's started to be some asks of kind of the next rung of financial organizations or banks, kind of the next size down below the very large ones that were targeted initially. And so, you know, if I compare it to a year ago or so, a year ago was probably just a very small group of major organizations that were kind of getting ready. And now I would say all major firms have some very comprehensive plan, and the next rung, you know, are kind of working through their plan. So it's definitely trickling out there. I will also add, kind of for non-financials, I've spent a good amount of time with some of our clients in non-financials, and over the last 6 or 9 months, you know, non-financial corporations and market participants are starting to have, you know, readiness plans and organization around it, and so that's clearly, you know, happening as well.
That sounds pretty encouraging, you know, with a little over a year out away from transition.
Well, we're a little over 2 years out because it's the end of 2021. You know, again, it is encouraging that a lot of people are working on it, but I would also highlight that, you know, 25, 26 months is not that much time to do a lot of the things that we need to do. And so, you know, I would also message that people who aren't, you know, as deep into their work on it, do get engaged. That being said, even the folks that are engaged, it's a very long body of work. There's a lot of things that need to be done. I highlighted the infrastructure needs, the operational processes, the different product types. And so, we definitely are going to use all the time that's given. It's a very important, foundational change to the system. And, we got to get people going and the major banks are, and it's important for the rest of the market participants to come along.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, you're talking about transitioning away from arguably, the most common reference rate or one of over the last 45 years.
Probably the, right? I think the Fed published a report that it had between $350 and $400 trillion worth of reference in the system. And so, clearly a very substantial amount of financial contracts, for sure.
One of the things that we hear about when we hear about transition is the idea of fallback language and documentation. If I understand it correctly, and please correct me if I'm presenting this wrong, the idea that there's sort of if LIBOR goes away, what happens to anything that this is tied to, that this document's tied to, kind of language. Do you think that that's one really important? And two, do you think that there is enough of that language out there or starting to be put out there on the street?
So, obviously fallback language is critical. You highlight one way in which it touches. Obviously, if LIBOR, if you think about a classic floating rate note, it pays a coupon, LIBOR plus or minus a spread. In the document, it says where to pull LIBOR from, and then it has some set of instructions if LIBOR can't get pulled. Those instructions typically only contemplated a temporary cessation. So, for example, if the markets close for a day because President Reagan has passed and the current president decides to close markets for a day and therefore stuff isn't published, people are quite comfortable with the fact that the markets will reopen the next day and just carrying over yesterday's rate to today because the markets are closed makes some semblance of sense. But when LIBOR doesn't get published, and if you carry yesterday's rate for the remaining of the outstanding of that obligation, maybe that was not the exact intended purpose of the language when it was written. And so one of the issues is that a lot of the legacy securities, mostly before 2017, and the reason I say 2017 is because, Andrew Bailey, who's the chair of the FCA, gave a speech in the summer of 2017 that kind of cemented this end of 2021 date. So any kind of language before 2017 probably didn't really meaningfully contemplate a permanent cessation. Stuff after 2017, obviously, because this was in the market, definitely started to contemplate it. And then earlier this spring, the ARC, that Alternative Rates Reference Committee that I referenced earlier, has published recommended fallback language across all asset classes. And so we're seeing a very high percentage of all new production in the market that does reference LIBOR. And I would highlight that we're seeing, the production of LIBOR stuff decrease, but the stuff that is referencing it is by and large using this new language. I think the focus of fallback language is going to be on some of those legacy, older securities where it wasn't really contemplated, and that's where a lot of energy is going to be spent on ways to think through how to transition and manage out of those positions.
You talked about newer issuances, either having language or maybe being tied to something else. We have seen more of that. One of the things I kind of wanted to shift gears on is talk about some of those new reference rates and, really start with SOFR. So let's say, we transition to SOFR. One of the things we've been talking about here is, as we look at this transition and we look at what's happened in the market over the last couple of months, does some of the volatility we saw with SOFR, maybe that was a one-off that we saw in the last month or so. But does some of that make us question it as a benchmark or rethink the way we think about it as a benchmark?
So, look, I think the recent volatility in SOFR should not derail any of the way we think about it or such for a couple reasons. Reason number one is one of the things that we're migrating to is transaction-based benchmarks, transaction-based references. And so when you have transactions, that reflects real activity in the market. And so if we're going to affect real activity in the market, there are real days in the market where things move, right?
Mm-hmm,
there are days
mm-hmm.
where prices of assets move around in the market. And so if we're going to want to reference what happens in really in the markets, then we have to be comfortable referencing what really happens in the market. So that's kind of the first thing. The second thing is SOFR is just an overnight index. And so on September 17th, when the repo rate moved, you know, the SOFR rate moved a couple hundred basis points higher, that's only worth one out of 360 or 365 of the value, right? Because if you have a 3-month LIBOR obligation that becomes a 3-month average SOFR obligation, a 200 basis point move or 200 something basis point move in SOFR for one night might only be worth maybe 2-ish basis points over the 90-day term. But we've seen LIBOR move 4, 5, 6 basis points, you know, multiple times, you know, kind of overnight. And so on a kind of an average basis, that move of 4 or 5 basis points in a 3-month LIBOR is worth a lot more than that one night move in 300 basis points. It just obviously the size of the numbers are very different, you know, when put out into the public ether, but the mathematical impact of the move was actually net smaller than some of the moves we've seen in LIBOR. And then the last thing is that, you know, when we had the volatility in the market, you know, a few weeks back, there was not meaningful issuance in the commercial paper or the interbank lending markets, right? And so we still saw trillion plus volume in the repo or the SOFR market. So we had real transactions and real activity to reference. Whereas if we were still, you know, kind of in a thinking in the LIBOR space, there was not real volumes and activity going through. The market kind of got quiet during that period. And so I actually think that the bout of volatility showed kind of the value and the health of referencing SOFR. And then people are just going to have to, you know, understand that there's going to be real market events that go through real markets. And quite frankly, you know, that's the way it is. But mathematically, it was less impactful and probably more robust.
That's really interesting. I mean, I took you had 3 points, but sort of one in three, I kind of put in the same bucket that, listen, we're operating in markets. We want a true market rate. And your takeaway there is that, one, we need to understand that. And two, the third point was that this is more representative of a true market rate because there wasn't really transaction activity in LIBOR. And then the other big point that even when we saw these spikes, it wasn't like all of a sudden we saw the rate gap out. We would have seen the rate gap out, you know, 10, 15 basis points because of the smoothing out of averages. I think those are really key points.
Yeah, I think that's very clear. Look, I think SOFR is going to do a good job over time of tracking reasonably closely to the monetary policy rate. And so if that does a good job of tracking to the monetary policy rate, it's going to be a true, quote-unquote, interest rate over a smooth period of time. And I think that, you know, if people want to reference a true interest rate that's coming from policy over a long period of time, SOFR is going to do a really, really good job of that.
And so it doesn't sound like you think that, you know, anything that happened in the last month would change the way we're sort of preparing for that transition in your mind.
No, it definitely hasn't changed, you know, things here at all. Obviously, it has increased the volume of questions we've been getting, but which quite frankly is in a different kind of way super helpful, because I think it's helping people understand and get more comfortable and understand the way in which the world is moving. So these things are all good in helping the education process. And then, you know, one other thing that happened is we saw volumes in SOFR linked kind of products, you know, swaps, futures, et cetera, spike very high. Volumes went way up in SOFR-linked contracts over that period because it was moving around. People were trading it. It got a lot more volume. So the other thing I would say is it helped add to the liquidity in the market over that period because more and more people were trading it.
That's a great point, too. And you know, more liquidity means more price transparency, so that's a good thing. What do you think about, you know, we've also heard a lot of talk about some of the alternative benchmarks to SOFR, not the ones you referenced earlier in the UK and Europe, but things like Ameribor. What do you think about that? Do you think it's possible that we have a world where you have, you know, multiple reference rates? And if so, is there any issue with that?
Well, so a couple things. One is, if I think about some of the things that are kind of already in flight here, is that, the FSB OSSG, the Financial Standards Board Official Sector Steering Group, which is pretty much the global set of regulators, and ISDA have kind of laid out that the path for the derivatives market is to migrate to the kind of central bank produced RFR rates. So the SOFR, the SONIA, the ESTR, the TONAR in Japan, et cetera. And so the derivative market, the fallbacks and the migration in the derivative markets and the activity in the derivative markets are likely going to stay centered in those rates. The other thing that we've had is FASB has come out and approved SOFR, for example, as a hedge accounting rate and kind of indicated that they will only do so for risk-free rates. So when you have hedge accounting and derivatives and some of the key things that are out there, kind of already linked to SOFR, I think it's going to be hard for any other rate to really get any meaningful, substantial dent of market share in the market. That being said, will certain organizations reference certain rates to do certain activities? Like, yeah, of course. Like, I think there's always room in our economy and for the creativity for things to kind of happen in that space. But, given where the derivatives market's headed and where the accounting boards are headed, it just feels to me like the SOFRs of the world are going to be the preeminent dominant rates in the market, and people should kind of focus accordingly. Is kind of how I think about it.
Well, I want to close. You touched on hedge accounting with FASB, and I want to sort of close with kind of a different question related to just hedging broadly. And I'm just curious, as we think about transition, do you think that, I mean, it depends on the given balance sheet, but are there certain hedging opportunities that any financial institutions or any banks should maybe be considering in terms of the transition away from LIBOR? But I don't want to put words in your mouth, but after listening to you talk about this, I mean, if it sounds like people are working on it and if all goes as planned, then, we just hand off. So maybe it isn't a huge need for hedging or hedging opportunity or that it would be any different than it is today. But I'm curious, do you think that there is any real sort of opportunity or need to think about that?
Well, look, I definitely think there's going to be, there's definitely some. We're talking about 350, 400 trillion of transactions that reference these rates. There's going to be a migration in the system. I think that counterparties, clients, end users, everyone in the system has to be very thoughtful about how and when they transition. There's a lot of real economics on the table, as a result of that. There might be a difference in trading versus relying on the way the fallbacks go through. One of the things I think about is if you trade yourself through it, you kind of are sitting in the driver's seat. If you let the industry kind of take its course and the fallbacks go through, then you're riding in the passenger seat. And so you obviously want to think about giving yourself the steering wheel and making sure that you're in control of whatever makes sense for your organization, your book of business, your client relationships, those types of things. I think those are all kind of super important things to think about as you migrate through. Obviously there's a substantial amount of infrastructure readiness, comprehensive work that needs to be done kind of on the legal contracts, operations, model system side, et cetera. And so, one of the things that I encourage people to think about is making sure that you're ready to absorb when the liquidity migrates. We're talking about an end of 2021, beginning of 2022 date that's been laid out there by the official sector. But I would argue that when liquidity starts to substantially move, that's when kind of it really starts to matter. And if liquidity moves 3, 6, 12 months before that date and you're not ready, you know, that's clearly not the place that you want to be. I think, you know, one of the messages that we want to send to everyone is, you know, full readiness and preparedness, because, you know, one wants to be in control of their own situation and not at the whim of the market.
Great. Well, I think that's great advice, and it all kind of plays into you didn't use this, so correct me on this if you want, but I feel like it's, you know, don't sit back and wait for this. Be ahead of it, you know, be in an offensive position as we transition away, opposed to in a defensive position.
Yeah, I mean, that's clearly, you know, clearly if you're in control, you'll be in a better position to manage whatever it is that your organization needs to manage through. And there's definitely risks that if you do it from the reactive position, you know, you could be left in either, you know, a less liquid situation or something that might be uncomfortable for your organization, for sure.
Well, terrific. Well, Jason, thanks so much for taking the time to share your insight. We appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me, and appreciate being here.